From Sylvain Labs, welcome to Critical Nonsense. On our show, we dig deep into cultural ephemera and pose questions to each other to inspire interesting conversations. This is Critical Nonsense. This week, Aaron asks Joey about the value of nostalgia, and Joey asks Aaron about what happens when the NFL dies.
Woo!
Tee-hee. This is what a Joey sounds like.
Baha. This is what an Aaron sounds like.
And this is what a defensive coordinator and executive producer, Jess Vander, sounds like.
This is Jess. This is Sports Team.
Yeah, I like the show Sports Team, and I want to watch that show with you hosting it. It sounds very exciting. I'm in.
It's a show where a bunch of people who don't know anything about sports commentate sports.
Wait, I think this is an SNL sketch that you and I need
to write. That has to happen? Yeah. Oh, I'm very excited.
Absolutely.
Real quick. Correction from the correction committee from last week. If you have corrections on us, please feel free to send them to criticalnonsense@sylvainlabs.com. Hulk Hogan was Mr. Nanny.
Yeah, yeah.
And Michael Keaton was Mr. Mom.
True.
I'm sorry.
Failed you.
We totally did. And Mr. Keaton, if you show up in that Beetlejuice sequel, we'll still go see it. We're ready for it. I mean, I am ready.
Is this
for
a
it.
Personal plea to
this
Michael
is
Keaton?
A mixture of a personal plea and a rumor that has died over the course of the summer. So I need it to come back immediately.
Got it.
Yes.
Email Michael Keaton. And if you have issues with something that we say that's incorrect, email us at criticalnonsense@sylvainlabs.com.
You think his email is michael@keaton.com?
Yes. I'm sure it is. But actually, it's an interesting segue and a good segue, because what I got on my mind is something that goes back to like the Batman days and the not the original Batman, but like 1990s Prince Batman. Because it is the Prince Batman. It's not necessarily the Michael Keaton Batman.
Got it.
Whole different thing. Prince Batman's question about the artist formerly known as Prince did quite a bit of music for the Tim Burton 1990 Batman film, as well as its sequel, Batman Returns.
So you're giving Batman to Prince instead of Michael Keaton?
Absolutely.
Okay, I mean, got it. Just to clarify.
He played another flying thing in Birdman, so I feel like he only gets one in his career.
Prince
right?
did own anything he touched.
Every time a newscaster comes on and says there's a 25% chance of precipitation, I cross my fingers that it's purple.
Including Sheena Easton's entire discography.
That is true. Yeah. No, it's true. Why would I be talking about 1990s Michael Keaton? One of the big things that has been bouncing around in my orbit has been a little bit of Batman, a little bit of Charlie XCX, and a little bit of Spyro the Dragon. And I'll get into that in a minute, because it's sparking the question for me, what do we lose when we lose nostalgia?
So what you're telling me is that you are nostalgic for nostalgia.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I think that's kind of what's going on right now. I strongly believe that there is just this like...
This feels like it belongs in that website, that Tumblr that existed for a long time of absurd or sort of Byzantine or hyper complex emotions for the modern time.
Yes.
It's like ennui regarding the nostalgia for nostalgia.
It's so brilliant, because even had to look up a dictionary definition of nostalgia, because I feel like we talk about it a lot around our office, at least from time to time. But that wonderful dame who is only better than Judi Dench, Dame Merriam-Webster, it's two different people, it's last names, defines nostalgia as a wistful or excessively sentimental yearning for return to or of some past period or irrecoverable condition. So my beautiful diction in that case, notwithstanding, I think that there is this really like complex compounding in our current age for like what nostalgia actually is versus fascination with something that happened recently that was kind of cool.
Mm.
So hot take. Is it toasty in here? Ooh, I'm wearing a sweater. So yes, hot take. Charlie XCX and Troye Sivan have one of the songs of last summer, 1999.
Yeah.
It goes through various references to Britney Spears coming out with Baby One More Time. It comes out with Jonathan Taylor Thomas. It comes out with Chokers, and just like it's drenched in this like really strong 90s nostalgia. They were like 7 when that song came out. Or when those things happened. Like neither of them have any recollection of living through those fads from that era. And that song is just one shard in a much bigger cultural movement that's been happening over the past really 5 years that has been a pure, unabashed obsession with the 90s by millennials. Or, well, Gen Z, really, like younger than millennials.
I have a lot. So first thing.
Hit it.
The website is The Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows. One.
Ooh, nice.
Two, that song is, I totally agree, right? Like, and it fits in this idea of the Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows of longing for a time that you didn't belong in, right? Or like golden ageism, like if only we could go back to the 90s, you know, that idea of wanting to live in a time that you didn't makes sense with this song that you're talking about. But also, you know, there are even worse versions of it. Your favorite artist, Bruno Mars and Cardi B, when they did Finesse, is literally just like, hey, remember the 90s? We made a shitty song about it. Yes. And
come on.
I mean,
the song Bruno is not good. But I don't have any issues with Bruno Mars, although Aaron does.
Just making sure.
But I have nothing at Bruno Mars, but
Bruno Mars is the math equation. Like, he is derivation. He is the derivative of everything. That's what it is.
But I think there is this thing of literally that's what they're selling. They're selling like that feeling of remember when it was good?
Yeah. And I think there's definitely, of course, there's a technological reason for it. And when I think that there's an interesting bridge between the late 90s and the 2000s where you have the internet, of course, blowing up, and you start to see over the course of the 2000s with YouTube launching and a lot of other different properties actually coming around that you can then access all of these fragments that used to be inaccessible. You know, when Merriam-Webster talks about the irrecoverable nature of these things, the internet made so much of that dynamic recoverable. Mm-hmm. Like, you can, as I have many times, sit at home with your friends and watch the Gummy Bears theme song, or like just listen to the theme song and watch the intro. Oh, and then binge watch a whole bunch of episodes.
Humming sample of the Gummy Bear theme song.
Words. Gummy bears bouncing here and there and everywhere. That's all. Yeah. Yep. Always go beyond the hum.
So your question at the top of this was what do we lose if we lose nostalgia? And I don't know if we lose anything, because I think we're in like a bad space in theory with nostalgia right now, where you're starting to get into like a little bit of an Ouroboros potential, right? Like the snake snake eating its own tail, right? In 10 years, are we going to have people who have nostalgia about this Bruno Mars track or the Charlie XCX track that was having nostalgia for time before that? Like, with the internet, you sort of have this opportunity to constantly consume things. And if you're looking backwards, which, you know, there's merit in looking backwards, but you have the potential to just kind of keep looping back on yourself. And when are you getting to something new? There's this study that a psychologist or an anthropologist did, or sociologist, I don't know, we'll throw it in the show notes after, but it was about different cultures and the way that they perceive time, whether it's looking backwards sort of in the present or forward looking. And there's a lot of things that go around it, around sort of latitude lines and how religious they are, or what is like a prevailing theme within their culture. But a lot of times when you have cultures that are looking backwards, they're unable to make advances, right? Or they become less inventive, or you're not looking for something new because you're placing value on things that happened retrospectively. Mm-hmm. And so if everything that you place value on is backwards, then you're not looking for something new or to create something new. And I feel like nostalgia is sort of a symptom of a rear-looking cultural perspective.
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument that comes up a lot around Ariana Grande as being the pop culture.
Oh, yeah, Thank You Next is exactly this also,
yes,
right?
Yes, 100%. And she's been doing it since her first single. Like, she's been doing it since The Way, when she was, everybody's listening like, wait, is Mariah Carey back? Because she can do a whistle note. Now, Just want to take a pause. When Mariah Carey did it, everybody was saying, is Minnie Riperton back? But let's put that aside for a minute. This sort of...
Just shouts to Minnie Riperton?
Absolutely.
I have no idea who that is.
Musical sample. Love! Nope, that's just going to murder people's
ears. Oh, I know who.
There you go.
The Burger King commercial.
Yes. Actually, yes.
Alex, can we get a Minnie Riperton note coming in right now and just listen to that? Mm, just sway.
All right, that's enough.
So my point is that we have been going through this sort of snake eating its own tail thing for a while, where we look to the past for some sort of inspiration. But right now, I do agree with you that we're sort of stalled. We have been in a place, I think, where there is a pop cultural paralysis as a result of this inability to unlock the wistfulness of the nostalgia itself.
Question.
Yeah. Right. Tell me what you think about me.
So I was watching a Jonathan Haidt video this week. H-A-I-D-T, not H-A-T-E.
Yeah, or Haidt, H-A-I-G-T.
I think that's how you pronounce it. And he was talking about our inability to have open dialogue and disagreement. And specifically, he's a professor on a college campus. And he said, I feel comfortable having disagreements or saying things on, I think it was like a Big Think video or something like that. I feel comfortable having disagreements here, but on a college campus, I can't, because people will anonymously report if they disagree with something instead of having an open dialogue about it. And so that dynamic of creating a system where you have anonymous reports instead of talking to someone directly makes people start to feel to hold back, like they can't say something, like they can't come up with a new idea or have a disagreement in a situation, even if it's respectful, right? Like if you have an opinion and in the moment my first response is something that is contrary to that, do I have to filter because I believe that it's going to be something that will offend you, even if it's unintentional? Like if I offend you, it's okay if I apologize, as long as it's not, you know, some extreme hate speech or something like that. But people are holding back. And this sort of nostalgia idea is allowing people to say, like, this worked. And if I can't feel comfortable bringing up a new idea in culture or saying something that is maybe unique and maybe a little polarizing or is not sort of an idea that's already vetted in culture, I can just go backwards. And I wonder if sort of our speech policing that we're doing in general pretty broadly, like call out culture and things like that, of someone says something and you're like, look what they said, shun them, shame them, point and hiss. Is that part of why we're like, all right, it's scary to say something new, so I'm just going to say something. I'm going to do the Carlton right now.
By the way, he's now a host of America's Funniest Videos, Alfonso Riviera. But that's a side note for what I watch on Thursday nights. I think one of the things that you highlight is that we're in this like spasmic time of contrast, in terms of we're at a hyper-polarized state where there seems to be more conflict or ideological conflict on a day-to-day basis that's in the open, but at the exact same time there's this desire to run away into our pods and retreat to the things that we feel comfortable and know about and to be around like-minded people, and the reinforcement of the bubbles essentially. So we're getting this, like, you know, everyone's going to their sides and they are fighting in online spaces a lot, but at the same time they're all going away to rally around like these comfort places. And I think that is one of the reasons why nostalgia for this particular era is so popular right now. Like, the 90s were pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, economically in the US, things were really fantastic. International conflicts were actually fairly low. We had technological explosions happening with the internet and cell phones, yet we still had people connecting one-on-one, like in Friends.
Yeah, I feel like that is a really fascinating point, to me at least, which is nostalgia right now might be equivalent with comfort, but that was not the case for people of other generations, where they were eager to eschew the past and move on to the next thing because the future was looking more appealing.
Yes. I love that, because in the 90s, actually in the late 80s, when Nickelodeon was being developed as a TV network, there's an oral history called Slimed of Nickelodeon that is so fantastic. Everybody should read it.
About it.
But a lot of the designers, a lot of the people who were creating the network in the 90s, you know, were basically building this network as a counter response to the 50s. Mm-hmm. So even a lot of the art direction that was used, the content, like Clarissa Explains It All. If you look at the aesthetic of that, if you look at Mr. Wizard, like empowering science with kids and all that kind of stuff, but still being this friendly grandpa. I think that there's a lot in the book that talks about specifically them pushing back on the 50s and the Norman Rockwellian overtone that had been talked about. And Joey and I have talked about Tim Burton also had his career launched as a result of pushing against that sort of normalized suburban Avon calling situation.
Yeah, you can't say that on television was like a very open mm-hmm. satirization of 50s ideals, right? Like you had the fat dad with mm-hmm. the wife beater t-shirt on with stains on it, and he was like dirty and grungy and looked like he had like smoke stains all over him, and he was like yelling at the kids, and that was like very much sort of satirizing the idea that the 50s had like sort of an ideal model of the family, right?
Yeah, you kind of, I guess when you start to lose nostalgia, you both, it's interesting because you both kind of lose this potential to move forward. You move this sort of, lose this potential for momentum, but at the same time, you potentially lose the opportunity to create a counter narrative like that. Because mm-hmm. you kind of needed the Norman Rockwell nostalgia for an earlier time to create a conversation that a Nickelodeon would start to push against.
See, I would love that if that Bruno Mars and Cardi B track or whatever was doing something about that was like satirizing the 90s, where you can still sort of lean into like what was cool about it without just sort of idealizing it, right? And say like, this is cool, whatever, but like, it's pretty dope right now too. Or like, wouldn't it be cool if it was like this, something that felt, you know, to your point, not just like hyper derivative or even just, you know, rinse and repeat.
Yeah. There's like it's like a flattening of it without an interrogation of it, mm-hmm. which feels like we've been doing that for a few years now. Like I'm ready for something else.
Yeah. What we're trying to say is Bruno Mars, just like do something good. Okay.
Please.
No, not what this is.
So we got two song breaks in that last segment.
Hoping for another one.
I will be awestruck if we can get some into this one, because this has been not a great week, y'all.
So many levels. So many levels.
This week, Kareem Hunt, a running back for the Kansas City Chiefs, one of the more elite running backs in the NFL this season, was let go by the Kansas City Chiefs because allegations came out. A video was released by TMZ of him in some sort of domestic assault situation in a hotel lobby. The NFL knew about this in the past, and in so many ways it sounds like the Ray Rice situation from years ago completely repeating, where the NFL knew about something. They, in quotes, investigated the situation and then put it to rest, and the person goes and plays on the team and everything is fine, until TMZ again gets a hold of the video, releases it to the public, and then the NFL decides that it's time to be contrite. They release this person. And my question is, the NFL is clearly demonstrating that they have no sense of morality, even though they want to beat their chest and point to their badge, right? The NFL logo, they say protect the badge. They want to beat their chest and say that we're like the bastion of morality in America and we're doing so much great. But every time they're confronted with an issue, they do the wrong thing. And so what happens when the NFL dies? What do we get next?
I hope we get a break from NFL culture.
Yes.
That's what I'm really hoping. I don't want any sort of phoenix to rise from that set of ashes. I want it to be dumped on, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. I think there is an aspect of the NFL, and this is maybe what I was trying to get at and didn't articulate as eloquently as I could of a shared cultural thing. Like, this is one of the shared cultural things that does still exist, that so many people are watching NFL games, and it's something that you can go somewhere and talk to anyone in a lot of places in America in a community and say, like, did you watch the game on Sunday? Like, it is that, like, how's the weather? What car do you drive type of thing. And it gives you an opportunity for connection and shared moments. But it's just, there's so much wrong with how they've run things that you want to say, like, you know, is there something else that we could have as a shared moment, a shared thing that we all agree that we'll watch and connect on that isn't consistently fucking up?
Yeah. I mean, so this, and I think it's not a surprise. I am not a sports person. I don't watch sports on TV. I played sports very poorly in grade school. And
you were an amateur skee-ball, touring skee-ball enthusiast.
I mean, the folks in Waco were so nice to me when I got together with Chip and Joanna and we had like a nice celebrity ski-off. It was really great. They named it the Ski-Boff 2018. So I give that preface because I'm curious, like, what has NFL culture meant to you? Like, how does this play a role in your life in general?
I mean, I think there's a lot of insidious aspects to NFL culture that we don't even particularly know about or don't seem front and center. Like, you know, I think supporting veterans is an important thing, but the way that the NFL does it is that they're paid by the government for these contracts to produce, you know, camouflage hats and to do all these promotions, and they make it seem like, you know, we're doing the right thing, but it's really just they're paying to the highest bidder. You know, if Aaron, you had enough money to get that contract, they would just put your face on every single logo or special hats coming out at the end of the year for particular games. And it's sort of, there is this culture of violence that people pretend isn't part of it. And when you have these athletes who are competing and you know, having to be violent on the field, and that's what you root for, but then they go out and be violent out in the world, and you're like, well, that's not what we're here for.
Yeah.
There's such a clear contradiction. And I've grown up, I played football, I've watched football for a long time. And, you know, in the past few years, I've tried to almost completely cut out consuming football just because of the violence, because of CTE and the concussions and the political aspects of the way that the NFL has conducted itself. It just, there just doesn't seem to be anything meritable in it anymore.
You know, I know very little about football, but a few years ago, Radiolab put out this episode about the history of football, and it was fascinating because it was at the time, which was towards the end of the 19th century, football was also nasty, brutal, violent, not a great sporting activity until the Carlisle Indian School, which was like basically a school trying to assimilate Native American children, which is a really bizarre, you have to listen to the episode, but basically they created a sort of it's not professionalism, but it was sort of like there was a very courteous and respectability.
But they were also breaking the system. Part of what, you know, Pop Warner was the coach on the Carlisle team, and he was breaking all the rules. And in some ways, the sport is one of the most progressive sports. Like, they're constantly changing and adopting changes in the league faster than most other leagues are. Like, if someone implements some tactic or strategy that works, the rest of the league starts adopting it, and they're constantly. But then socially, the league is quite conservative, and it's sort of put out to be this very conservative, like, bastion of American values, or, you know, and that is even in conflict.
Well, I mean, if Tim Riggins from Friday Night Lights taught me anything,
he taught you everything.
Literally, basically, I need to learn how to do crunches. I don't know how I get them abs. But if that show, which is an amazing show that everybody should go back and watch, taught me anything, it is that it really did prove to me that organized sports truly do build character, and they truly do provide, I think, a structure and discipline that is, you know, developmentally not necessarily a part of like our educational system and other socialized spaces that we're in on a day-to-day basis. And so I've got a strong appreciation for sort of what the sport can do, especially for younger kids. But what blows my mind is that at the NFL level, to your point about just domestic violence, the things that have turned me off about NFL culture have been like multitudinous, like to say nothing of just the like hyper-masculine othering that's built into this and the assumption that if you are not the biggest, fastest possible, if you are not like this physical specimen of domination, then you're not only not welcome, you're not a man. Like that sort of equation, of course, turned me off. But then you've got the dovetails of domestic violence, racial issues, not to say nothing of Colin Kaepernick or the fact like Kansas City Chiefs. Why are we still having conversations?
That's better than the Redskins.
And they both exist. Like it infuriates me so deeply in my soul. And it's just like it brings out and draws out. It actually goes a little bit back to the nostalgia. Like people have such a nostalgia for these sports teams that fuels the money that people then pay for the jerseys and all that, and also equips these owners with an argument for why not to change these incredibly offensive names to these teams that are literally turning people into mascots to like denigrate and like pretend you're like. So all of these things, like, and you throw a little like Roethlisberger cherry on that Sunday, like I'm done. Like, I don't want Amazon to tell me when the next game is on. I like want to throw my phone against a wall whenever I see that. It drives me crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I went through a period where I've actively taught myself to like basketball and learn the league, and over probably now like a 3-year period, so that I had somewhere to turn that passion, because I didn't want to give it to the NFL anymore, just because it feels like, you know, we're watching people literally sacrifice years off of their life with things like CTE and and the violence that people with CTE have turned toward their family. Or you look at someone like Aaron Hernandez, who likely had CTE and murdered multiple people, and you know, Junior Seau killed himself. Like there's so much of this in for your enjoyment, you're watching people shave years off their life, and it's hard. Like I once that's in your head, it's hard to reconcile when you're watching. But I want to know what's next. Like and it doesn't have to be a sport, but I think the shared cultural moment is important. Last year in 2017, 37 of the top 50 most viewed television shows in the United States were football games. 37 of the top 50 for the year were football games. It is serving a cultural and community purpose, even if the output itself is not great.
Okay. Disturbing thought. But hear me out. Yeah. What if it's already here? And what it is news politics.
Fascinating.
And
fascinating.
The governmental situation in America.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I was thinking about this yesterday, and I don't think it is overly political to say that things are really fucked up right now and we don't know where they're going. But the last thing that I can remember that like could have been on par with a certain televised event that I'd imagine is going to happen in some ways in the next couple of years is OJ running in the Bronco. Mm-hmm. Like between that and, of course, unfortunately, 9/11, those are the two times that I remember like when school was like rolling TVs into classrooms and like everybody huddle around and like watch this.
Yeah.
And it feels like those moments are happening, like we're having like micro versions of the like OJ moment every other week, every other day. Granted, Alan or The View is covering it with quite a high level of bombast, and that's been very, very interesting.
Yeah.
I heard this morning that Meghan McCain and Joy Behar are in like a big fight, but like that's not it. Go ahead.
I think, you know, if we went back and looked in 2016, I bet you the political debates probably were part of that top 50 mm-hmm. most watched thing. And I think you're right. The difference is the sort of feeling of heft that you invest in political debates that feel larger and more important because it's how the world is shaped around you.
Yeah, because it is more important than football.
Right. But football gives that sort of competitive us versus them type of thing, or sports in general, us yeah. versus them in a slightly more healthy way. You know, Russian football hooligans or British football hooligans or, you know, Alex Cantel, maybe the Spanish football hooligans, I don't know, sort of put the outer limits of that. But it is something that you like leave on, you know, your team loses and you're upset and whatever, but you kind of leave it on the court, so to speak.
Yeah.
Wait, but this is fascinating. Like, what if the NFL, sports, whatever, where we may have previously diverted these energies to, if it's not scratching that itch for us, maybe it's making it more appealing to mm-hmm. divert our attention to, I mean, yeah,
the politics,
the debates.
It's also that, like, with sports teams and all that, like, you've got a lot of rivalry and tribalism that's based on geography, whereas mm-hmm. in politics it's based on nationwide ideology. So mm-hmm. like, not only are there fewer teams for you to really be a part of in that world, but also like your tribe is both much larger and much more distributed than it is necessarily geographically with sports teams. And also that sort of like badge of pride that you fly up in those situations is more likely to be like seen and acknowledged in places that you haven't been before. Like, you know, if you're a Bengals fan and you're in San Diego, like, you can fly your Bengals flag, but it's like, okay, how many other Bengals fans are there going to be?
Dot question.
Mm-hmm. Love those.
You are the king or queen of the broadcast television world, and you get to wave a magic wand, and you can take all of those eyeballs that are being drawn towards cable TV and put them anywhere. You get to choose what is going to replace football as that sort of like national pastime. What do you pick?
RuPaul's Drag Race. not kidding for a heartbeat. Like, no doubt. And I've got a reason for this. So number one, I feel very strongly that the premise of Drag Race.
You came so quick. RuPaul's Drag Race.
Like always. I mean, like, I'm a mega fan, but I think that the fundamental idea of Drag Race is self-interrogation. The idea that like everything in life is performative. Don't take life so seriously. Appreciate the fact that we're all putting on costumes every day and do something with that. Like,
I love this.
It's something that
I'm here for it.
Yeah. It's so much more like fundamentally inspiring and provocative than other things. And then on the other hand, then there's just like entertainment value. There's like the craft of all these queens who do amazing makeup, who make their own outfits, who come up with amazing creative numbers. Like, it celebrates this fantastic creativity. And there is no tribalism. Yes, the RuPaul's Drag Race Reddit community notwithstanding, there is not like some march or like there's never a riot when Trixie Mattel wins All Stars 3.
Yeah.
Shangela was robbed, but we didn't go running out into the streets flipping over Suburbans. So I feel like that is somewhere that if more of America's eyeballs could be focused on that, we'd be in a better place. It has in the past year actually taken the top spot of one of the most watched TV shows in the world. And RuPaul's Drag Race UK was just greenlit, so we've got three seasons coming from
it's coming for you NFL. All right, right, Jeff, what are you?
Oh, I just have to say, this is extremely hilarious for me because I'm from outside of Philadelphia, and I was trying to imagine, because Philadelphians go crazy over sports, and I was just trying to imagine what would Philly people do if they were all as into Drag Race as they are into watching Eagles.
They were fighting each other over Shangela's number.
Shangela? So first of all, it is Shangela.
Shangela.
I like your version of Shangela. But yes, they would say at the end of the day, because Shangela's grown a lot over the past 3 years. she's done great, great work. I think that's the thing. Like, I think that sports, politics, especially right now, is feeding the dark side of competition. It's feeding this us versus them rather than celebrating the things that make us awesome as humans.
My answer is Great British Baking Show.
Yes!
competition.
Yes.
There are winners and losers. Everyone is nice. You learn something about what a, you know,
tartine.
What is a puff pastry?
Gotta make that rough puff. Gotta make that rough puff.
If you're making a shoe, you don't want it to be overwicked.
Can't overwick the shoe. You also have to be really smart about which type of meringues you're going to be using. Like, hello.
Italian for this?
Yeah.
Are you crazy?
Gotta get
the
that
textures are off.
Yeah, gotta get a good shine on that Swiss meringue. A nice shine on it when you bake it. Yeah. Mm. Very brittle. Very brittle.
Yeah. And marzipan?
Okay. Marzipan melts beautiful in tarts. It can really.
I say the NFL needs a replacement. I'm happy for it to be the NBA, but if it's RuPaul's Drag Race
or Great British Bake Off
and Boston sports fans are fucking going crazy over Shangela
or Katya, because she is a Boston girl, then we're in a better place.
Yeah, we're in a better place.
Nice. We solved it.
Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain Labs production.
Recorded in MacGyver Studios in beautiful New York, New York.
We'd like to thank executive producer and burgeoning semi-pro skee-ball touring professional Jess Vander.
We'd also like to thank football hooligan and sound engineer Alex Contell.
We'd like to thank designer Nora Mestrich for her beautiful artwork on our cover photo and her amateur skee-ball skills.
We'd also like to thank the crew of Joker's Henchmen for production help. Sarah Gilbert, Les Jacobs, and Tony Vong.
And as always, thanks, Alin.
Thank you, sir.
We'd like to do some special thanks, as always.
Yeah, who do you want to thank?
I'd like to thank the patronage of Chip and Joanna Gaines for starting your professional skee-ball league.
They're so nice. They were part of SPAT, which is the Skee-Ball Association of Texas. I also want to thank LeBron James for being an idol in the NBA. Keep doing what you're doing, man. Yes.
I'd like to thank Shangela because I need to learn more about you, but the joy that you bring, Aaron, is just... Yeah, I'm always grateful.
Always. Along with that, I'd like to thank Michelle Pfeiffer and Halle Berry for giving us better Catwoman than we deserved.
I'd like to thank anyone who turns off Bruno Mars' microphone.
Ooh.
I'd like to thank you. Next.
Well, you won thanks.
Yep. Just got it. Gummy bears. Bouncing here and there and everywhere.